listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international relations, about two items, including a very interesting want ad that was put out by the Wall Street Journal for a Moscow bureau chief. Mark, first of all, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Don. Happy to all the listeners out there in the U.S. and wherever else in the world you're listening via podcast.
It looks like it's going to be more of the same, only on steroids. We'll start with the reportage in the U.S. And I saw this morning at RT a piece that it was entitled Wall Street Journal Needs a New Moscow Bureau Chief, Only Opponents of Russia Need Apply, and featured in it is a tweet from you with this attachment of a job description. This is what the Wall Street Journal wants. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, I noticed this this tweet from Miriam Elder. Miriam Elder is one of these Russia-watching journalists, as they call them. She's at now at BuzzFeed, that great source of catlisticles and dating advice that also pretends to do some news as well. But she was passing around a job advert for a Moscow bureau chief. And I was kind of interested because I've noticed this rotating musical chairs between the Moscow correspondents in the past couple years, and it's really actually increased in the past few months. You go from the New York Times to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post to the Guardian, and the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, back in the circle around, right? You've got the idea. So I clicked and checked, and they're passing around the job advert. And really excitedly encouraging each other to apply, especially women, as Miriam Elder suggests, more women need to apply. But so I had to go and read this job advert, and it's and you can find it. It's still on the Wall Street Journal's website. There's no attempt to hide this even after the news has come out. So and the reaction of the Western journalists to this and their reaction to the criticism being none shows you how normal this is, right? I'm going to highlight this here. So Bureau Chief, Moscow in Russia, job description. The Wall Street Journal is seeking an experienced and enterprising journalist to serve as Moscow's Bureau Chief and spearhead ambitious coverage in Russia, its economy, politics, foreign and security policies, and people. Okay, yep. The Russian story is more important than it has been in decades. Yep. No disagreement. With the country playing a much more assertive role on the world stage under President Vladimir Putin, a course that has increasingly put Moscow at odds with the U.S. and much of the West. Hmm. I'm not quite sure that it's not the U.S. that has been trying to play a more assertive role and interfere in Russia and China's and other people's backyards.
I would say, like, for example, if you use troop deployment as a measure of that, the tanks have been rolling towards Russia and not vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, and there's no question that U.S. troops are now stationed on Russia's border and not the other way around. And it's the U.S. that was trying to overthrow governments in Syria and Ukraine and not the other way around and so on. Libya and so on. All right. Let's continue on. No, we're looking for someone who can lead wide-ranging reportage. I'm not sure that's an actual word. Delving deeply into the economic underpinnings of Russian power and Mr. Putin's own grip on domestic politics.
Grip,
his iron grip.
Yeah.
Getting inside Russia's hacking complex. Not that I'm sure that anything's ever been proven there, and certainly not because the U.S. does any hacking itself, Stuxnet, Flame, you know, anything that. And chronicling Moscow's activities in the Middle East and elsewhere. Okay, not so happy about Syria, I guess, being defeated there.
Right.
A central goal will be explicating Russia's strategic aims and exploring the country's fraught relations with the Trump administration. An American official's assertion that Moscow used a campaign of hacking and disinformation to try to sway last year's presidential election.
Well, can I ask you just in that sentence, first of all, this is something that had me scratching my head. It's not something that you highlighted, but the country's fraught, Russia's fraught relations with the Trump administration. I don't even understand what the hell that means, because Trump is being, you know, accused of, criticized for being soft on Russia or a puppet of Russia or whatever. So what are the fraught relations they're talking about?
Well, I would assume it's because they're referencing, you know, that Trump doesn't actually have any control over his administration and that the cabal of generals in the deep state that are actually running his foreign and security policy, Mattis, McMasters, Kelly and others, that they are not very fond of, you know, Pompeo. They're not very fond. That's what I assume they
Okay.
Or what they want to be the fraught relations, or what the deep state has sabotaged any attempt at détente between the two countries. That could be it as well.
Okay.
I'm just guessing.
Right.
Yeah. Not that any of that has been proven, hacking, disinformation, but I mean, even the Washington Post just came out with a piece within the last 48 hours, which admitted that even if we accept that there was some type of Russian effort to influence the election during social media, again, not that the U.S. does. Oh, wait a minute. The U.S. and the U.K. do that. And we've seen countless reports, in the Western press about it, interfere in other countries and try to sway things in Iran and elsewhere. But even the Washington Post admitted that there's no evidence that anything that Russia may or may not have done had any effect on the election whatsoever.
Right.
And in fact, it's pretty fairly unlikely. But anyway, we'll continue on. Now we get to the real juicy bit.
Yeah.
Another will be looking at Putin's role as a champion of so-called illiberal democracy.
I mean, what the hell is that? Illiberal democracy.
So who calls it illiberal democracy other than you, the Wall Street Journal, I guess? I think we've had this discussion before on you know, democracy, liberal democracy. Mm. Liberals often conflate the ideology of liberalism with the methodology for determining the will that is democracy. It is right. A common liberal conceit.
Right.
And there's this framing attempt that anytime a liberal is not elected in a country,
right.
Whether it's a conservative, whether it's a leftist government that, you know, that is elected, then that is not a legitimate government because right. It is not a liberal democracy. It is right. By definition, illiberal
right.
Democracy,
or at least
or authoritarian, you know, rather, right. Even the word conservative has disappeared from right. The lexicon.
Right. Right.
We only have liberal and illiberal in it.
Right.
Who has sorry. Become a beacon for right-wing politicians across Europe and even in the U.S.
Mm.
A beacon. Well, I mean, I can't argue that there are some right-wing politicians in Europe and Hungary and Austria and elsewhere that they, I would consider right-wing, you know, generally in the conservative sense, and they don't rabidly hate Russia. I mean, they right. Still back sanctions against Russia and so right. on, but they don't rabidly hate them as much as some other countries' governments do. I can assume that's what they're talking about there.
Yeah. What about the fact, though, that when you have, say, votes on sanctions like this at the UN or discussion in the, you know, Commons about all of this, some of the strongest defenders of Russia are, in fact, the left, Maduro and, you know, Ortega, Castro, et cetera, et cetera. They're not right-wing, neo-right, neo-fascist, not by any definition, and any of these clowns that call themselves leftists that criticize those people, they're out of their minds.
Oh, but those are authoritarians, Don. They may not be right-wing,
forgot.
But they're also authoritarians, because anything that is not liberal democracy is Hitler.
I forgot that.
Yeah. Just want to remind you.
Oh, thank you. Jesus, it's hard to need a scorecard, I mean, you know.
when Tsipras and Syriza was being elected in Greece, there were similar calls that Russia was leading a far left rebellion against. Mm-hmm.
Right, that's right.
Far left forces as well. That far left, far right. Well, you know, to be fair, since it is the center triangulated.
Right.
Neoliberalized center right and center left
right.
Imperialist as well in both the EU and the US that is so intent on exerting US military force, hegemony abroad, you know, that it only makes sense that Russia reaches out to the right and left ends of the spectrums that are not in favor of that policy. So
right.
I guess maybe that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yep. Yeah.
Then we get to this. His traditional conservatism of blood and religion.
Sounds like blood and soil.
Amid economic uncertainty. Resonates amid economic uncertainty. I don't know what economic uncertainty they're talking about because Russia is at the exact same growth rate, 2.5%, as the U.S. and much of the EU. In fact, higher than much of the EU. So I don't know what economic uncertainty they're talking about there.
And that growth rate in the U.S. is like monster growth rate compared to the last 35 years or thereabouts.
Yeah, his traditional conservatism. Okay, but first of all, Russia is a fairly socially conservative, economically statist or leftish country, and Putin largely, respects that.
Right.
You know, he's pushed. I would say more. He's been pushed in that direction by the Russian people and events than the other way around.
Right,
but. There are many people in Russia that consider Putin to be far too liberal. Far too liberal for them. We need to point that out. And those are by far the strongest opposition forces in the country. Be that from the communists on the left, or be that from the so-called Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, soft nationalists.
Zhirinovsky types, right? Yeah,
They in different ways, they both consider Putin to be far too liberal to lead the country.
Right.
And blood and religion. All right. Again, most of the country is far more religious than Putin is. You know, I haven't seen that he's called for you know, any type of Orthodox revolution across Eastern Europe or anything like that. And blood. I think they're making some kind of reference to ethnic nationalism or something there, yeah, which exactly. Just shows how ignorant they are of Russian politics, because there are ethnic nationalists in Russia. They're usually on the fringe. They're pretty much the equivalent of white supremacists, the far right in the U.S., and they have about as much support. You know,
right.
They hate Putin and his government for the last 12 right. years. They actually ally politically with the liberals on the street. They did right. during Bolotnaya protests, you know, during Putin's last election and so on. Because he is in favor of a federalized, you know, the Russian Federation,
right.
Russia as a, shall we say, organic multicultural government. You know, Russia does have some 200
ethnic groups,
ethno-religious groups, some plus 200. Right. Not to mention, it's the second largest source destination of immigrants, both legal and illegal, in the world, after the U.S.
Really?
Yes, really.
So, I'm hearing the echo of, you know, the Blut und Boden of Germany, where they use this blood terminology, and it was even predated fascism. It was from the 19th century, but the, you know, the Nazis used this as a rallying point. Blood meaning, you know, the Aryan blood, and so what they're doing is kind of, you know, it's not even a subtle way of ascribing that kind of racist ideology to Russia.
Yeah, and if they had wanted to do that, they had better take a look at the putsch they supported next door in Ukraine.
Really?
To see an actual
Nazi
blood, you know, argument, an actual
right.
bit of ethnic nationalism, right. an actual where, I mean, just again this year, it's happened every year since, you know, since the Maidan was going on. But on January 1st, both in Kiev and at 50 some other locations across the country, most in Western Ukraine, there were marches, torchlit marches at night. You know, the things they aren't so crazy about in the U.S. when they happen right. in Charlottesville right. or elsewhere, and I understand perfectly why.
Right.
In honor of the genocidal Nazi, the West Ukrainian genocidal Nazi collaborator Stefan Bandera's birthday. This has been going on. It's been growing. The Kiev regime has instituted this Institute of Historical Memory, which has been attacked by actual historians all across the West for their attempting to rewrite history and portray these Banderites, the Ukrainian insurgent army, the UPA, and as some kind of anti-Soviet freedom fighters, when they were actually genocidal Nazi collaborators that right. were hip deep in the Holocaust in Ukraine, yep. and quite willingly so,
yep.
as such that even the Germans at times felt they were too brutal.
Yeah, they're put off by it, like, whoa, these guys are crazy.
Crazy. I mean, and that's saying a lot. Okay. So this is going on. They're trying to rename streets all across the country after Bandera and then lots of his other associates there. And yeah, that's where they really should be looking there. And perhaps the best line the one that ties it all together at the end here. We're looking for an accomplished candidate who can report and write major stories. We're also leading a team of other top-notch correspondents to deliver world-beating coverage of this critical story. Strong Russian language skills are a distinct advantage. Okay, so let's make this clear. Russian language skills to be the Moscow bureau chief are an advantage.
Right.
But it's not absolutely necessary as long as you tick all the other political and ideological pre-assumptions
right.
and biases.
Not for nothing. This is written by...
That are necessary for this job.
This is written by the people who run a newspaper. They talk about burying the lead. That's the last sentence in it. Now, if you're going to be parsing what goes on in Russia and you can't read Russian, what in the hell are you... And you can't speak it, so when you go out on the street and the guy goes, psst, Tovarish, Slushite. You know, you don't know what the hell he just said. What are you doing there?
As long as you are ideologically sound on these
right.
other points.
That's right. Right. That's right.
They, you know, the people that they have there can actually cover for you, I guess. You know, right. we in Russia, we hear all the time complaints about the Russian media not being objective enough, being too critical of the U.S., being anti-American and everything. And, I usually just laugh it off. You know, we are involved in an information war. There's no question about that to me. I have always doubted, you know, these claims. I think always we should call into question the idea of journalistic objectivity from everyone. I mean, there are always different worldviews, different national interests, different ideologies, different corporate editorial lines, you know, what have you, that constitute, you know, what you write and how. And usually any even a pretense at objectivity is just a varnish put on top of your opinions. My advice has always been to read multiple news sources from within a country, from different political perspectives, from different countries, and try to ascertain what makes sense to you. Right. They have a big problem with RT's slogan, question more, because that you should never question their narrative. You know, and this is exactly what this job description is. Their bias is directly built into their job descriptions, right. such that it actually sounds like an op-ed rather than a job description. And this is what it's required to become a borough chief in Moscow. You have to believe, you know, these things, these, and some of them which are demonstrably false, and some of them which are very questionable.
And this is for the Wall Street Journal.
This is one of the top papers. And not only that, but the other journalists in Moscow were passing this around without batting an eye.
It's
perfectly normal.
I wonder how much it pays.
To be fair, it is perfectly normal. They don't see anything wrong with it because they all have this opinion already. But at least let's do away with any idea that Western reporters in Russia are in any way fair, objective, or balanced, you know, fair and balanced, what have you. They're not. You know, this is an information war. And as far as I'm concerned, this is just, you know, them not even being shy about advertising that fact.
So while we're talking about this, you know, kind of, let's figure out the narrative by reading the media of, you know, the countries on either side of a controversy and others. Let's go to some big event that's going to take place today for as long as it takes for Russia to veto it at the UN Security Council, where Nikki Haley is convening a hate fest, basically directed at the government of Iran. And at Press TV's website, they point out that people have been in the streets for the third consecutive day in support of their government in the millions.
This whole Iran protest story has gone all out of control, quite by purpose, in the Western media. As soon as they see protests in Iran, a whole lot of neocons and, quote, experts, unquote, who have no real knowledge of Iran whatsoever, crawl out of the woodwork and begin calling as one voice for regime change. And this has been ridiculous from the very beginning. By all accounts, there has never been really any more than 15,000 people in a country of tens of millions protesting against the government in these protests. And from everything that we can tell, I mean, even admitted in the Western media, these protests didn't even start as anti-government, as in anti-systemic, anti-establishment protests. Right. These were simple cries, for economic address, a cries for the government to address their economic problems.
Cut the price of bread or whatever kind of thing. Exactly. Unlike
the green protests in 2009, this wasn't in Tehran. It started in the regions. It was actually the working class, working class poor of the regions outside Tehran in the country, that these were the first people who began to protest. And there is a lot of talk. I can't judge whether, you know, it's accounted. It seems to be credible and widely reported that actually the conservative forces in the country, in the government, you know, within the Iranian government, within the parliament and so on, actually supported these protests because they're not actually too happy with the current president Rouhani, who is viewed right. as a moderate and a liberal.
Right.
Or as they see it, as an appeaser. Right. But that somewhere along the line, these protests were either hijacked, as they say, or a parallel protests were set up by people who started with all kinds of for what is Riyadh, rather radical anti-government statements, calling for the death of the Ayatollah, right. throwing for the overthrow of the government. And they quickly became violent, right? Again, we heard this line of peaceful protesters. And there have been, as to my count, some 21 people at least killed within the last 4 days in these protests. But if you look very carefully, you will see that the very first day there were any of these, quote, protesters, unquote, killed, they were armed and attacking military barracks and police stations to try to take them over. Mm. I mean, this is exactly what happened in Syria.
Yep. And Libya.
And Libya as well, right? And there hasn't been any direct indication other than the regime change rhetoric flowing out of the president, the Pompeo, the director of the CIA, Nikki Haley at the Security Council, you know, openly calling basically for regime change in Iran. I want to draw your attention to a article in the New York Times. This article was from June of this year, June of 2017.
Last year, yeah.
Yeah, last year. Sorry, we're already in 2018.
Yep. Amazing. Yep. That.
CIA, this is the actual title of the article in the New York Times. CIA names the Dark Prince to run Iran operations, signaling a tougher stance. This was on June 2nd, 2017. Ayatollah Mike is a Michael D'Andrea. He's known as the Dark Prince in the CIA. He was heavily involved in the renditions and the torture during the Bush era. He's widely expected to signal a stronger stance, a harder line, they say, more muscular approach to covert operations.
Yeah, under Pompeo,
They're complaining that Iran's intelligence service have spent nearly four decades trying to counter American espionage and covert operations. Mm. So they're putting him in. He can run a very aggressive program, but very smartly. It goes on and on here.
And this is, by the way, this president is the one who said no more regime change. People need to remind him of this constantly.
Last June, the Wall Street Journal at the same time also reported that the CIA had sped up a special operations cell specifically for covert operations in Iran. Hmm. The Central Intelligence Agency has established an organization focused exclusively on gathering and analyzing intelligence about Iran, reflecting the Trump administration's to make that country a higher priority target for American spies, according to U.S. Officials. The Iran Mission Center will bring together analysts, operations personnel, and specialists from across the CIA to bring to bear the range of the agency's capabilities, including covert action. I don't know, but... Right. If in the last few days you have mentioned that the CIA may be involved, you know, at least exacerbating the situation on the ground, you know, even as small as it is in Iran, you were dismissed as a conspiracy theorist.
That's
why
right.
would you say it? Yeah. Right. You know, why? I mean, forget the fact that the U.S. you know has admitted that that it helped overthrow the Shah. You know, with a CIA coup, it's kept Mossadegh and the elected socialist government of Iran and reinstall a monarch in that country, which right. then led to the actual blowback of the Islamic Revolution in the country. Never right. mind that, and all the actions since then. I mean. How do you dismiss these reports? I mean, and we hear the calls, you know, for regime change, and then poo-pooing any suggestion that the CIA might be involved. Please. Out of the same New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal that earlier eagerly reported that the CIA was setting up dark princes and covert operation cells against right. Iran.
Here today, okay, today's Voice of America News, VOA.com. VOAnews.com. Ibadi, you know, Shirin Ibadi, who's the lawyer in exile in the UK from Iran, calling for people to stop paying electricity, water, and gas bills. They should not pay their tax. They should withdraw their money from banks. This is a call through the U.S. media to the Iranian people on what they should be doing right now. Tell me that this is not meddling. You know, we're not talking about buying $100 worth of Facebook ads.
Meddling. Yeah. Well, we don't do that. You know, meddling. Well, you know, according to the Carnegie Mellon University researchers at Carnegie Mellon, only 81 times up till 2000, and not counting any regime changes or invasions, and not doing anything since then.
Right.
Or not counting anything since then.
Okay.
You know, this is just incredulous. You know, the idea that the U.S. Wasn't involved. Lawfare blog, which is one of the biggest sources of the so-called resistance, published an article openly calling for terrorism in Iran to hand out improvised explosive devices, wow. Indiscriminate explosives to protesters in Iran. They openly wow. called.
That's actually a crime against humanity to do that.
Yeah, they did actually, you know, it is terror. It's a crime against humanity. And then they had the editors issued a response to the outcry and said simply that they wouldn't withdraw the article, that it was simply too emotional
right.
and didn't have legal analysis, but they were perfectly fine with the message.
We're publishing it. Thanks. All right, Mark, we're going to follow this up next week. Thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, give us the lay of the land as we glide into 2018.
Yeah, when you look at a kind of brief summary of events in the region, it looks as though it's like kind of business as usual in many ways for Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yep.
But my take is that I think that 2018 is going to be an even more difficult year for Latin America, and paradoxically not for Venezuela. Because then it seems to me that 2017 enabled Venezuela to kind of exorcise most of its political demons.
Yeah.
And that it's now, and commentators generally agree that there are good prospects for Nicolas Maduro to get reelected at the end of this year. So long as he can achieve some improvement in the Venezuelan economy. And it looks as though...
Yeah, they're positioned
The oil price heading up, and even without the oil price heading up, the measures that Nicolas Maduro and his ministerial team are taking in Venezuela should do a lot to improve the sick conditions for ordinary people in Venezuela. So... But for the rest of the region, and the outlook is extremely uncertain, and it seems to me that the underlying dynamic there is that the regional elites have not assimilated the fact that the policies that they've advocated, you know, forever, since the 1980s, really. Neoliberal Washington consensus style, structural adjustment style policies just don't work. And shall we start with Argentina?
Yeah, but you know, before we say what does and doesn't work, we have to be clear on the terminology, because you know, if you're the 1% or the 10th of 1% or 100th of 1% sitting on top of the heap, and you institute some program that enhances your economic and political position inside the you know, structures of political economy, just because it's terrible for everyone else doesn't mean that your program failed. Au contraire, it means your program succeeded. So, you know, from that point of view, maybe we're talking about failing to deliver for, you know, a sufficient political constituency to maintain it. But it's a success for the people that instituted, because their program is looting, and they're doing that rather effectively in some of these places.
Yeah, and another way of, that's right, and another way of, because my take on it all is from the point of view of the impoverished majority, but and another sense in which it fails is that the institutions that have been built up over the last 10, 15, 20 years can't resist the tensions that result from the policy failure from the point of view of the impoverished majority.
You know,
and so what?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
So if you look at Argentina, for example, what we're likely to see through 2018 is continuing abuse of the country's institutions, and Mauricio Macri's government has already engaged in more layoffs of people working in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And there are continuing protests on the various issues to do with, for example, the pensions issue and other related administrative issues to do with public policy that affect the living conditions of ordinary people.
It's that same architecture of austerity that, of course, produces a response that ended up leading to the last government that they had there in the first place. We've talked about how he really can't go anywhere but sort of, I was going to say not back to the future, but forward to the past.
Right. Yeah, and that's absolutely clear, and they... I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised the other day when I read that Argentina is now in negotiations with the IMF.
Come on.
Which is absolutely crazy. You know,
replay the whole epic.
Yeah, and Argentina is one of the wealthiest countries in the region. It's in negotiations with the IMF about how, and what the IMF is prescribing is the... incredibly, the same old structural adjustment medicine: more private, more privatization, more opening up of the economy to it's even more open to, as you say, global investment looters than it has been over the last year under Macri.
Which means more looting, and which means more austerity, which means
more debt. I mean, Argentina is going to issue yet more debt in order to fund Mauricio Macri's government program. And so, and then if you look at things from a human rights point of view, all the human rights organizations in Argentina are up in arms over Macri's policy and the judicial policy of being very lenient with historic torturers and murderers from the dictatorship.
Right.
Most of whom, a recent report discovered, most of whom are under house arrest. They're not even in jail. You know, and one of the most notorious criminals of the dictatorship has just been granted house arrest, and that's what led to this look at, well, you know, what is the judicial policy towards these heinous individuals and their crimes? And that's it. And they get treated extremely leniently. And look at the case of Milagro Sala, which is ongoing. Now she'll soon be entering her third year of imprisonment, but she hasn't been sentenced to anything.
Right.
There's no judgment against her.
Right. And the same thing they're doing with, you know, they're trying to do with Da Silva and that they, you know, with Cristina you know, Christina de Kirchner, excuse me, the same thing that they do with their political opponent. You know, oh my God, we found a parking ticket. Well, maybe it's hers from 1998, 50 years, and plus you can't run for office.
Right. So yeah, and these ridiculous claims around the Amir terrorist bombing case, which we'll certainly right. hear more of in the next few weeks.
Right.
Which are a blatant attempt to disqualify Kristina from running in the next presidential election.
Which, by the way, let's be clear, she had nothing to do with the government when that happened.
Oh yeah, absolutely. What she's accused of is covering up the subsequent investigation by trying to negotiate with Iran, by trying to talk to Iran about what their version of the involvement of Iranian nationals in the case is. And it's classic. I mean, in the same way that the Lockerbie bombing had nothing to do with Libya, and that's been categorically demonstrated, but it was used as a pretext to attack the Libyan Jamahiriya government. And then in exactly the same way, and it's just one more example of a long-standing practice by the United States and its allies to abuse their own involvement in terrorist attacks and turn that against their latest target.
Well, you know, a better example, the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the United States.
Right.
Right. The people, the victims of that, were barred from suing Saudi Arabia, the domicile of it was like 15 of the 18 people involved or whatever. And clear ties had been established with government officials and such with the players involved. Somebody once misspelled Iran in third grade or something. And so even though the families couldn't sue the Saudis who were responsible, somebody sued Iran for a couple billion dollars and won a judgment in the New York federal court.
Yeah, of course they did. So anyway, and that motif of abuse of terrorist atrocities in order to attack geopolitical opponents is a long-standing practice of the United States and its allies.
Yep.
And going back to Argentina, looking at there's growing concern around the Argentinian government's human rights policies, they just promoted one of the officials most intimately involved in the disappearance and subsequent death of Santiago Maldonado.
Right.
Which we covered a lot last year.
One might say consequent death, actually, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Consequent death. Right. Yeah. So look at Argentina, and it's difficult to see how Argentina is going to involve very serious unrest through 2018. And if you look because of that mixture of a repressive elite trying to institute extremely anti-democratic, anti-humanitarian policies against the wishes of the majority, but they'll point to the fact that they did better than they usually do in last year's legislative elections.
Right.
But that supposed electoral triumph that they projected as, you know, a huge achievement for Mauricio Macri, and they didn't even win. They won just over 40% of the vote.
Right.
And the only reason that they did well, that they won so many seats as they did, is because, again, the opposition was divided.
Right.
And we can see that in reverse in Venezuela.
That's right. That's exactly what happens. Before we leave Argentina on this point, I just want to back up for one second, because as they engage again, another cycle of insanity with the World Bank and IMF and that whole architecture of God knows what, you know, Macri's term began with him handing over more or less the last payment on the last round when he decided to pay those vulture funds their money, handing Barack Obama, you know, a check for whatever it was, $12 billion or whatever, that they legally were not obligated to pay.
Right. Absolutely.
So, sorry, go ahead.
So, yeah, and things in Argentina are not going to be tranquil and stable through 2018, and that's true for so many countries in the region. And going back to Venezuela, what happened in Venezuela is that, and Pablo Vivanco has written a really good article in English about giving a summary of events, bringing people up to speed on what the political situation is in Venezuela. Pablo Vivanco's the Telesur English editor. And he published an article, I think it was last week, and it's worth hunting out to get a good profile of how things currently stand in Venezuela. Now, what happened in Venezuela, when I say that it was the reverse of Argentina, I do not mean to imply that Nicolas Maduro didn't have majority support. He did. But the key thing about Venezuela is that the opposition is so divided that they're unable to put together a convincing, plausible, credible policy program,
right,
or to run an efficient election campaign. And so that, but even if they did unite, and their united vote, it was demonstrated on what was it, 3 electoral occasions last year?
Yeah.
The two
plebiscites, the one that was conducted by the opposition, the one by the government, and then earlier, the actual elections later.
I was referring to the National Constituent Assembly on July the 30th.
Oh, so there are four.
The regional elections early in October. What was that, October the 15th, something like that.
Yeah.
And then subsequently in December last month,
right,
the municipal elections, in which the opposition couldn't agree what their common policy was, and some parties participated and some didn't.
Right, so actually we have 5, because then you have those 2 plebiscites also.
And in all of those exercises, Nicolas Maduro demonstrated that he has a structural majority, a structural democratic electoral majority, capable of defeating the opposition. And the opposition have no response to that. Now, as 2018 wears on, the oil price now is, what is it, around $60, a little over $60.
Yeah, I haven't looked since last week. I don't know.
So, that means what I recall is that before the dramatic collapse in the oil price, when was it, 18 months, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that. The $60 was regarded as a good break-even point for Venezuela. Would enable them to maintain a healthy surplus, from their main source of foreign exchange. Venezuela. When we start talking about Venezuela, it gets really complicated because there are much broader global geopolitical things going on in relation to Venezuela. For example, the petro yuan and the petrol oil transactions being carried out in non-dollar currencies, in particular Chinese yuan, and you end up talking about investment by Russian Federation companies, investment by China, huge investments by China.
By both. The ones from Russia also quite substantial that they've got on the boards that they're working out right now. You know, and there's some, you know, you got this geopolitical game that's going on around it. It's another area where really this a primary area, you know, going forward of economic warfare. The United States and Venezuela, of course, have been doing still a great deal of commerce in oil throughout pretty much everything that's going on since 1998. And, you know, they've been talking at least since November about that, you know, that's over or could be over.
Right.
So, and now Russia and China are stepping up to the plate, basically saying, hey, let's do business. China, you know, we got factories, let's drop Venezuela into the gas tank and crank out another 1 billion cars. You know, they're really looking at some major economic projects together.
Yeah, and apart from those those big economic projects. And at a grassroots level, the Venezuelan authorities are devising new policies to empower small businesses, medium-sized businesses, cooperatives, and in many ways, I can't help thinking that they've looked at what's happened in Nicaragua, which has been very successful in developing a grassroots, inclusive, participatory economy, mm-hmm. especially from the point of view of women here in Nicaragua.
Yep.
And it looks as though Venezuela is taking some of the best elements of that model and applying it to their own economy. Let's see how successful they are. But whatever level of success they get, it's bound to diversify the domestic production of the Venezuelan economy and progressively reduce Venezuela's dependence. And it's not going to happen in the short term, but in the medium term, it will definitely help to reduce Venezuela's dependence on its oil income.
Right.
So that's why I think that Venezuela, in strong contrast to Argentina, you're likely to see a dramatic stabilization in Venezuela. While in contrast to other countries like Argentina, but not just Argentina, in the rest of the region, another country where you're likely to see a consolidation of stability, if you like, is in Cuba, because in Cuba they've just had their elections. The National Assembly takes office. I'm not sure. It's sometime in April. I think it's the 27th of April, sometime towards the end of April. I can't remember the exact date.
Right.
But when they do, they'll elect a new president, and Raul Castro has already publicly stated that he will step down once the new National Assembly has elected the new president.
Right. So this is going to be a changing of the guard.
Yeah, changing of the guard, and the most likely candidate is a guy called Miguel Díaz-Canel, who's a currently a vice president, one of the vice presidents in Cuba, and he's very well known here in Nicaragua because he attends virtually every celebration of the anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution on July 19th.
Yeah.
And he regularly makes some strong speeches in expressing Cuban policy in the region and Cuba's commitment to working closely with Nicaragua.
Right.
So, and I'd be very surprised if it's not Miguel Díaz-Canel that's elected in April. But and that's a strong sign of the stability that
that's
Cuba
right.
Enjoys, yeah. And that's currently being reflected in the fact that. What is it? Federica Mogherini is currently visiting Cuba, and she's the essentially the European Union foreign minister.
Mm-hmm.
She's visiting Cuba, and she's publicly said over the last couple of days that the United States policy is illegal and obsolete
right.
towards Cuba,
right.
and she's encouraging the United States to change its policy. Well, that's a very big deal in foreign policy terms because
yeah,
it's another
is.
Example. Among the few, but increasingly, there is this strong disagreement between the European Union and the United States. And so for the moment, it just extends to issues like, well, do we recognize Cuba? Do we work with Cuba or not? And the European Union has very clearly taken the decision to work with Cuba.
Right.
Which is, you know, another slap in the face to the United States government's pathetic foreign policy failures. You know,
yeah.
and
more importantly, what it does is it allows Cuba to start engaging with, you know, a larger section of the global economy, and you know the sheer force of there are so many realities that are, you know, forcing themselves onto the stage in place of the hubris of the United States over, you know, the last, well, whatever, since 1776, but certainly since, you know, with Cuba policy, aside from we started out with the annual ritual at the United Nations where, you know, the whole of the 193 members or whatever it was at the given time, because this goes back a couple decades now, at the General
right.
Assembly in September or October, because they convened in September, they would have a vote and it would be, you know, the entire world says U.S. sanctions, bad, illegal, stop doing it, except the United States, sometimes Israel, sometimes either Palau or the Marshall Islands. And that was about it. And every once in a while, they get a penguin in Antarctica to vote on it. And sometimes the penguin abstained.
Well, yeah, and something very similar happened on, and which is very, quite relevant for Central America in particular, when the United Nations held a vote condemning the United States government decision to move their embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And the U.S. suffered a humiliating defeat in the United Nations on that issue.
And what's kind of hard for me to understand is, you know, I mean, I understand it from some other angles, looking at the various political activity that goes on, you know, that influences U.S. foreign policy. But the actual announcement was, they call it a nothing burger. The law was passed, the procedure established, you know, 20 some odd years ago. I think it was 1993, 1994, when the Congress said we recognize Jerusalem as the capital and we're going to move the embassy there unless the president certifies every 6 months or every year, I forget what, that the national security of the United States mandates that we postpone implementation. And so they've been doing that ever since. That's been the law. The U.S. policy is that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, legally, that's the policy, and that the embassy is going to go there. And as Trump made the other announcement, he again signed the waiver. So what happened was actually nothing except for this press conference, basically. And yet it galvanized. You know, it's almost like it was done on purpose to galvanize this opposition. It's kind of like what I'm watching with Iran right now. You know, I saw Trump, well, first he has Nikki Haley say some of the most outrageous things at the United Nations that, you know, the whole world almost lines up again, even people that, you know, nations that have antagonisms towards Iran, regional or whatever. Almost the entire world lining up saying, well, no, you can't have it like that. And it galvanized, you know, you went from having these, you know, few hundred kids with Molotov cocktails or whatever in the streets to, on one side, to like a million people in every city in Iran standing up for the government and for their, you know, for their political, you know, construct. And so it's almost like he does this stuff on purpose.
Yeah, and who knows what the motivations
are? Who knows?
Are.
Right. And who cares, really? It doesn't matter, right? Well, what's actually in motion? That's what we study anyway. What's happening? What's in motion?
Yeah, so but in that vote, and in very similar to the votes on the issue of Cuba and sanctions against Cuba, as you say, it was the Marshall Islands and Israel voting together, obviously, with the United States.
Right.
But they were joined by Honduras and Guatemala.
Right.
And Guatemala, under Jimmy Morales, who's doing everything he can to try and keep at bay the corruption investigations that have plagued him, that did plague him all through 2017.
Right.
And it's very clear that this decision by his government to also move their embassy to Jerusalem is an attempt by Jimmy Morales to curry favor with the United States and stave off the judicial processes and investigations involving his corrupt administration.
Well, you know, he doesn't have the same prerogatives that the U.S. presidents have, like Bill Clinton or George Bush or whatever. When something goes wrong here and they start investigating him, they bomb someplace. You know, like Clinton, you've got the thing with Monica Lewinsky, let's bomb Iraq. You know, with Bush, we've got, and actually they both, whenever something went wrong, seem to like to bomb Iraq. He can't bomb Iraq, so he's got to do this other stuff.
Right. And also Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, his government supported the United States in that UN vote.
Yep.
Hardly a surprise, because he's also desperately struggling for his political life, and he needs all the support that he can get now.
Yep.
And in Honduras,
you predicted that, by the way. You predicted that was going to happen.
Yeah. So in Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez is likely to take office, I think it's on the 27th of this month.
Yeah.
Salvador Nasralla and Manuel Zelaya, the leaders of the opposition alliance, have said that they're going to hold a rival inauguration.
Well, they actually did win the election. I mean, nobody's letting them take office. But as it turns out, they actually won the election, so they might as well at least have a party if they can't take office.
Right. So, and it, hardly anybody disagrees. Even the Organization of American States, whatever its motives may be, are saying that the election was deeply flawed and new elections should be held. Yep. And that the last time I looked at what the Organization of American States was saying, that was what they were saying. Whereas by contrast, the European Union was saying, well, you know, the vote was held, it was flawed, but that was the result. You know, so it's very strange that the European Union is actually taking a position even more supportive of Juan Orlando Hernandez than the Organization of American States. But from my point of view, my take on that is that what the Organization of American States is doing by taking this position is they're trying to protect themselves so that they have some credibility when they talk about Venezuela. And if they supported this outrageously fraudulent election result in Honduras, nobody would take them seriously. Even fewer people would take them seriously than do already. Ooh. So, and that's, I don't feel optimistic about the situation in Honduras, and that's another reason why I think that 2018 is going to be a very unstable year, that there's going to be greater instability across most of the region, even than in 2017, because in 2017, corporate media were able to cover up the widespread instability in Latin America by focusing on Venezuela.
Yeah, and you know, they've been able to avoid covering the widespread problems around the world by focusing on crazy stuff here too, like RussiaGate or whatever. And so we're out of time, and I want to pick up where we are now next week, because we have some more to update. Mexico, in some depth. Ecuador, of course, and what's happening there. Fujimori thing in Peru still cooking.
Right.
And so we'll talk again next week. And Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.